Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, our weekly look at food, farming, and the environment. And we have a lot going on today on the way there. I have to remind you that here at WEAA, there's a lecture series is returning in collaboration with the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. WEAA is presenting Girls in the Band, the untold story of female jazz musicians and their journeys from the late 30s to present day. Thursday, April 17th at 6 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, third Thursdays, and lecture series information available at 443-263-1800. And we'll be talking to those women as well. You'll hear that interview on this program. And remind you on the way to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's one word, marylandeducators.org. Or go to steinershow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association banner. And here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show, we open today with a conversation with Coach Mark Smallwood, who is executive director of the Rodale Institute and an organic farmer from Kutztown, Pennsylvania, though he has Baltimore roots as well. And, Mark, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you, Mark.
At least I won't forget your first name.
That's easy.
When I read your stuff, I said before we went on the air that what really struck me is that when you're writing about GMOs, industrial farming, but then look at the future as organic farming, I said jokingly, you take no prisoners. And he said, what do you mean? I said, because and your approach to it is that you said we don't have time.
That's right. Well, we have been dominated by one methodology of agriculture for about 100 years, and certainly for 70. The agricultural food system, which is really our biggest concern, is what we eat, has been dominated by a very well-known science, a well-respected science called chemistry. That's how we grow food in the United States and other parts of the world too, but it dominates our food system. We think that there's a better way to do it. It's also based upon a very well-known and well-respected science. It's called biology. And so what we do at the Rodale Institute is we focus on life in the soil. What they do in the industrial ag realm is focus on how much food they can grow for the least amount of cost. On the organic side, on the biological side, we're concerned about growing the highest quality food that has nutrient density, food that will actually act as medicine. And that all is dependent upon the biology and the life that lives in the soil. And organic growers focus on soil health and improving soil health, improving organic matter, for example. And on the other side of the coin, the chemical growers actually deplete soil life. And the soil, in our view, is the stomach of the earth. It's where the nutrient exchange takes place. But you have to have biology there.
Now, one of the things I think is important to kind of wrestle with here, because it's in many of your articles, is that I can hear people saying, wait a second, industrial farming, the farming, this large-scale farming, is what's feeding the people of America inexpensively and what's feeding the earth. And that organic farmers are great, but it's really a niche farming. Too expensive, people can't afford it. It's not realistic that we can transfer these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of, let's say, farming in Delmarva or across the state of Maryland into organic farms.
Okay, so let's go back to the original question.
All right.
where I stated that we're out of time. We've depleted soil so rapidly over the last 70 years that if you want to use the industrial ag model to feed the world for the next 50 years, I think we'll be able to do it. You can use chemicals and you can use GMOs. But 50 years from now, that model is not going to work. If people think they're going to be spraying Roundup 50 years from now, they're wrong. The only way to feed the world now, if we want to do it for the rest of humanity, is to do it with biology and do it organically. We have a 30-year trial. It's actually in our 33rd year, started in 1981 called the Farming Systems Trial.
What is that?
We grow organic.
Who's the we? This is Rodale?
This is the Rodale Institute. Okay, I was clear.
Right.
So Bob Rodale started the Farming Systems Trial in 1981. He came back from Washington, D.C., disgusted by the fact that policymakers kind of snicker and laugh at him. And he said, when are you going to take me seriously? And they said, Bob, you need data. Where's your science? So he came back to the Rodale Institute and he said, okay, everybody, I know what we need to do now. And he started the Farming Systems Trial. He designed it so that we are growing organic right next to conventional crops, corn, soy, wheat, rye, and hay. We actually do a rotation. And what we found after 33 years, so Mark, I tell everybody, it's not a 3-year study, it's not a 13-year study, it's a 33-year study. And what are the major points that have come out of this? And great data, great science, hundreds of scientists. Yields are the same after 33 years. And farmers don't look at yields year to year. They look at it long term. So after 33 years, no scientist would ever dispute that yields are the same. So when the pundits talk about organic and bash us and say, well, you'll never feed the world. The only way to do it is with this chemical model. We would say that the yields are the same. So based on yields, if we can't feed the world, then neither can they. Or let's take it the other direction. If they think they can feed the world, then so can we. The difference is we can do it well, and we can do it as we build soil health and as we build organic matter.
There are a couple things you said before we went on the air and articles you've been writing. I think it's important to kind of touch base here on that. Because it's obviously very controversial, but things are moving in directions they never had before. You were talking about the growth. I forget the date you gave, but you can give those. Of organic right now is $8 billion. It's now $31 billion. What was those dates you...
Yeah, so about 10 years ago,
right,
in the food and beverage industry, organic represented about $8 billion. Currently, 2013 data, the organic industry represents $31 billion. So the beauty of that is that we have some clout now. When we go to Washington, D.C. and sit with our policymakers, they sit up and listen now. We're no longer, you know, viewed as 4 acres and a hog. It's $31 billion.
There were a couple things you said I really want to explore, both in the articles and the things we were talking about informally. And I think it's important to point out this. We were going to do an entire program on this. We probably will. But the United Nations has put out a number of incredibly powerful reports that I think you alluded to and wrote about in some of the pieces you wrote. It was either Huffington Post or somewhere that you wrote this, that they're looking at agroecology and talking about how the only way for developing countries, for non-industrialized countries of the world, to feed themselves where starvation exists is not through GMOs and not through industrialized farming, but through small-scale agriculture and independent organic farming. That was and they came out again just earlier last year. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. So we In that same trial, the Farming Systems Trial, we call it the FST, and there's great data on our website, rodaleinstitute.org. You can pull up the full report if you like. Here's what we're finding out. We started in 2008. The agricultural community came to us and said, your data is no longer valid to us. All we grow is GMOs. And if you want to be validated by what dominates agriculture, you need to have data on GMOs. And so we indeed started to grow GMO corn and soy. And again, the yields did not change at all. And here's what's occurred in just 5 years. And it's the same thing that's occurring across the world, anywhere they've introduced GMOs. They work very, very well in the beginning. When the conditions are right, they perform. We outperform them in issues of drought. And so if you look at the agricultural community in California, for example, they've had horrible droughts over the last few years. And so organic then outperforms in yields. We spray Roundup on those crops.
GMO crops.
The GMO crops, yes. Of course, Roundup is not allowed in organic production.
Right,
so,
right.
So in the conventional GMO trials, we spray Roundup. In our third year of the trial, we had super weeds. Those are the weeds that are now resistant to Roundup. So now we have to come in and spray atrazine. Atrazine is a carcinogen. it ends up in the groundwater, and we have that data. And now, after 5 years, atrazine doesn't work on some of those weeds, so we are now applying a third application, another input, another cost to the conventional grower, and it's 2,4-D, which was the active ingredient in Agent Orange.
Right.
That's what the farming community is up against if they continue to grow using GMOs and conventional methodologies.
But do you have enough evidence from your perspective to stop doing that? You're just on the farm itself, I mean, just applying these things. I mean, ACT was a big argument we had here in Maryland, and we had a battle over banning it in Maryland because of just those reasons, because of carcinogenic, because of the hermaphroditic frogs that lived around it and everything else.
You know, when I first got hired, I said to Maria Rodale, that's who I report to. She's my boss. I said, don't we have enough information? It's 30 years. And she said, yeah, but this is the 30th anniversary. And so I started to shop that idea out, like, don't we have enough information now? Can't we rest on the laurels of the 30-year study and move on? And I got such feedback from the scientific community in particular that this study is so one of its kind. It's the longest study of its kind, side by side, in North America. And they begged me not to change it. They said, this must go on. This is some of the most important real estate in the world. And so we continued. I must tell you that I shudder a little bit when I have my guys that have to go out and spray those chemicals. They, you know, they wear the Tyvek suit, and it's disturbing. But I guess the information is so important that we're going to continue the trials. And our goal really, Mark, is to work our way out of a job. When we get to the point that we can rest with J.I. Rodale, our founder, his words, healthy soil, healthy food, healthy people. So we are digging into that soil piece. That's what we've been about for 50-plus years. The human health issue with food, we are now starting to dabble in nutrient density and things like that. Our ultimate goal, though, is to create healthy people. And once that happens worldwide, we can stop the trials.
I just feel so bad for the soil and the water around it. It's going to have to absorb all this stuff. But you also talked a bit about what happened near you in the town of Allentown, I think, and the mayor's inaugural address in January, which is really kind of stunning. It's a smaller city in Baltimore, but it's got poverty, it's got deindustrialization, it's got some of the same issues that Baltimore has faced in a smaller scale.
Yeah, I think demographics could match up in certain neighborhoods for sure. The mayor came out to visit us last year on the day before our organic apple festival. We have 1,100 certified organic apple trees, and we do a U-Pick festival. We have about 5,000 people there in one day. When the day's over, we have no apples left on the trees. So we invited the mayor out the day before. And he had a chance to pick some apples with us, and we had a nice long conversation about organic agriculture and this whole, the two models, chemistry versus biology. And he totally bought into the idea of the biology. And in his State of the City address, excuse me, in January, he said, we are going to be partnering with the Rodale Institute to create opportunities for organic agriculture in open space and vacant lots in the city of Allentown to feed people that don't have access to organic food. And so we are...
That's pretty radical and revolutionary for a mayor to do.
Well...
Not, I didn't mean that as a negative either.
Oh, absolutely not a negative. And he is a very progressive guy. His thought was, here's a way to set my city apart from all the others that are like Allentown, creating an urban agricultural, organic agricultural opportunity. And so we have training programs at the Rodale Institute where we're actually showing people through internships a pathway to organic agriculture. What the mayor has provided with us now is the opportunity for access to land. That is usually the biggest drawback to new farmers in particular. And even in the urban settings, access to land is difficult. So he is opening up the city of Allentown. We're going to spend the next year preparing and studying the best way to strategize and move this issue forward. And we're going to launch in 2015 this organic agriculture initiative.
That's pretty impressive, just because of one of the issues here. And by the way, folks, I apologize. You can join us, 410-319-8888. All right, just here at steinershow@gmail.com. I'll log on to our Facebook page. Just tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Many of you listening to us in Baltimore and other urban areas in our listening area, it'd be interesting to see what you think about this whole thing about how we can transform our cities. Because that's been part of the problem is that for many people, they may have seen you write that people should just buy organic and begin to change the way they do things. But organic's expensive. I mean, I was reading to you before we went on the air, in today's world, when I was looking at the prices at a local supermarket here, between organic green pepper, $1.99, conventional green pepper, 66 cents, organic bananas, 69 cents a pound, and then conventional, 49, family pack strawberries, $6.99 for organic, and $4.99 for conventional, and so on and so on. And so, and sometimes it's even higher. So, I mean, there's a real split, and a lot of middle class, working class, and poor working class families can't afford to buy this organic food.
We agree. There's two issues. Number one, it's very simple economics. It's a supply and demand issue. The demand for organic produce or organic products completely outstrips the supply. And so there's a pricing
right.
issue. And that's again, simple economics, supply and demand. The other thing that people don't realize, and I think just the general public is not aware of the fact that organic farmers receive no subsidies from the government at all. So when you see that $1.99 pepper versus the 69 or 66 cent pepper.
Pepper, yeah, right.
It's because the conventional growers are subsidized by the U.S. government. The organic farmer is not. And so when you see the price of the organic product, that's the true cost. Now let's take an example here of some of the environmental impacts that have occurred through the chemical industrial agricultural system. We have runoff from farms. We have runoff from golf courses. We have runoff from just your residential homeowners who treat their lawns, their turf, and again, the farmers who use chemicals. That ends up downstream in the Chesapeake Bay. And we have what is called a dead zone there now.
Right.
So what if we took
right.
what if we took the cost of the cleanup of the dead zone and went backwards to all of those who were responsible for it and handed them the bill, their share for cleanup? Now what would happen to the price of those peppers if that pepper grower who's been spraying toxic chemicals on our food, how would that change the price?
And I think that it's important to kind of come back to this point. I'm going to go to the phones here, but come back to the point of how this can change and also what happens to our land. And you've written very eloquently about the effect on our riverways and earth and our health from biting into pesticide-ridden apples and more. 410-319-8888. And Ludi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark, and your guests. How are you gentlemen doing this morning?
Very well. Welcome.
Great. I wanted to bring a statement. I don't know if any study has been done, because I know we were talking about the price points of organic versus the other foods, and I wanted to see if there's any studies done that show how the medical plays a part into this, because the things that are being sprayed on and we're ingesting that into our body as we get older, our medical bill surpasses what we would be paying for organic food, so why not pay a little more on the front end versus paying more on the back end? I'd rather eat healthy now instead of in my old age I'm paying an arm and a leg. And, you know, based on how our medical, the health industry is going, I think organic is the answer versus doctors. That's the point I wanted to address and make that comment. Thank you,
Lydia, so much for that call and that thought.
Yes, sounds like she should maybe be on the show at some point.
Maybe she will.
you know, there's a testimonial from one of your listeners that indeed the research needs to be done to prove that organic food is healthier. We have some studies, not the Rodale Institute. Dr. Liu from Harvard University did a study about 3 years ago with 10-year-olds in Boston. And what he did was he asked them to write down everything that they ate, and he did a quick 14-day study. He took urine samples three times a day, and for the first 3 days, he found pesticides in the urine of 100% of the 10-year-olds that were tested. He put them on an organic diet 3 days. 6 days later, tested the urine, no pesticides. Put them back on their diet that they started with, and 3 days later, pesticides back in the urine samples.
And how much of those pesticides residue is remaining in your bodies?
Well, of course.
Right? And not urinated out or defecated out.
Yes. So when you talk to Dr. Liu, he says, so all I found out so far is that the pesticides are inside those children. What do they do after that? That's really where the study and the money that needs to be spent in terms of research. But indeed, he found pesticides 100% of the times that he tested when these children were eating what we call conventional. And let me say very quickly that I think they got the word wrong down at the USDA.
What do you mean?
It's unconventional. It's not conventional. What our grandparents and great-grandparents did when they grew our food, that was conventional, and really what it is organic.
I mean, we've talked on the show before with different people, researchers and scientists at NIH, about the studies that have taken place in agricultural communities, which use a lot of chemicals on the crops that they grow, and the cancer rates, as well as something that's proven, but this is just the beginning research, the cancer rates and also the rates of neurological disorders that are taking place and how intense they can be in agricultural communities. And the evidence is beginning to pile up, but it's also got a lot of backlash to it in opposition.
Well, sure. I mean, the backlash and the opposition comes from industrial ag and all of the money that they have to pour into what they want to have the public know about. So it really is about the children. And when we have school groups and when we are have an opportunity to talk to children about what they eat, they're the ones who really get it. You know, they scratch their head and say, wait a minute, you're pouring that on my food? That doesn't make any sense. And that's the model that we need to change. And so we're working with a group of clinicians down in Washington, D.C. I just had a meeting yesterday. And we're trying to devise, believe it or not, what if a doctor could write you a prescription for fruits and vegetables? And you can take it back to the doctor and renew it just like you would a prescription for any other medication. And that's the direction that we at the Rodale Institute want to take the food system. So it becomes healing. It becomes a medicine again, not something that's the opposite, which is actually causing health issues, just like your listener talked about.
One of the things that was written in some of the pieces that have come out from you and Marie Rodale was that this notion, let's talk about this just for a minute, the next few minutes we have left, the idea that we could double food production in 10 years using organic practices. That also seems, to most people, antithetical to reality. Counterintuitive.
Well, it's just not true. I mean, of course we can. The issue is, are we going to continue to have to double the amount of food? Are we going to continue to have to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to 9 billion. How are we going to feed that many people? When's it going to be 18 billion? You know, at some point in time, there has to be some balance. And I believe that truly is what organic agriculture is all about. It's keeping things in balance with the way nature has intended things to be. If we stray away from the natural world, she will tend to straighten things out for us. And we must take good, solid lessons from Mother Nature. In terms of increasing yields, the way you do it is by increasing organic matter in the soil, by increasing its ability to take up and hold water, by increasing its ability to hold nutrients and exchange them at the root zone into the plant, not spray or add a water-soluble nutrient that the plant uses or loses, and it ends up in our creeks, our streams, eventually in places like the Chesapeake Bay.
So in conclusion, you think that a lot of our industrial farmers maybe listening to this broadcast could make a living and transition from what they are now to a different kind of food system?
Yes, and I think if we're going to subsidize farming, the money should be used to subsidize farmers that are growing conventionally and help them in the 3 years it takes to transition. That would be money well spent. And so If I can, I'd like to just give one final message, because this is really about the future and the legacy and what we are leaving behind for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, generations ahead of us that look back and they're going to say, so were you involved in all of that? And one answer is, yes, I was, and we're really sorry. We blew it. We left behind something worse than what we were handed. Or the question will be, so were you involved in all of that? And we'll be able to say, yes, I was. I'm very proud to say that we are now accomplishing things previously thought to be impossible, feeding the world organically, and we did it for you.
I want to say thank you so much for joining us in studio here. Coach Mark Smallwood, who's executive director of the Rodale Institute, will be linking into his much of his writing and Rodale Institute's work on our website, and looking forward to visiting you in Kutztown, Pennsylvania very soon.
Yes, we bring a busload.
We will. Okay. A small busload, but we'll bring a busload.
That's fine. Love
it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites and come back and meet a filmmaker who's made a remarkable film, Alan Moore, that will be on PBS this week about what changed Baltimore County. Stay with us.
The Valley is it's an extraordinary place, first and foremost. And like any place, it's not defined by the trees or the rivers or the streams, although I know that that's what is said in the word preservation, but it's always defined by the people.
We're stewards of this place. It really is up to us to preserve it and try and keep it as nicely as we can and to treasure it, to really do what you need to do to see that it we don't lose it.
What's important to me is that members of my family, my children and grandchildren, take an interest in the farm and carry on the tradition.
When you see the community, the way that this group comes together, it makes me very proud to be a part of a group of people that are this special, and more importantly, that care that much about each other, and as you can tell, that care that much about the land.
And that was a piece of the trailer of this film that's finally coming on Maryland Public Television, MPT, called Designing with Nature, The Plan for the Valleys. It was made by Alan Moore, as a filmmaker and a faculty member at the Maryland Institute College of Art. He's in studio. Alan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Mark.
And it's a film I saw a couple of years back when it was screened at the BMA. And it's a remarkable story. Let's talk a bit about it. I mean, I think that, you know, when you tell people, come to visit Baltimore from out of town, and you leave the city limits, and then as soon as you, like, leave the city limits, within 10 minutes or 15 minutes, you're dead in the middle of country. But you can ride bikes through, walk through, hike through, and be there. And part of that is what you're telling the story of is the movement that allowed that to be created some 50 years ago.
Absolutely.
Right?
There were members of the community who lived out in the valleys. There were several valleys.
Like Greenspring Valley and Greenspring the others.
And the Caves Valley and the Western Run Valley. And all the homeowners and landowners appreciated the beauty of the place and also the valuable agricultural importance of having farms that are operating and close to Baltimore. And there's a very strong horse community that likes to ride out in the open space. So the community got together seeing that there was suburban sprawl creeping towards Baltimore County. They hired a very innovative landscape planner named Ian McCarg, who was from Scotland originally, but was working at the University of Pennsylvania in a landscape architecture program. He and a couple of his colleagues created something called the Plan for the Valleys back in 1963. And it was very, very innovative. And his idea was to keep any kind of growth, which he knew would happen, on the ridges so that the valleys would remain beautiful and intact. So some of those ideas were brought forth and through zoning laws that the Valleys Planning Council helped, encourage. And so now we have, as you say, a community in northern Baltimore County where you can literally get off 83, 10 minutes from town, and be in beautiful open space.
And this is a period of kind of real it's a rush to kind of build these new highways, 83, 695, building this new world of transportation that we all get stuck in every day anyway. It's not a very fast mode of transportation.
No.
Yes, it's all stuck. But so this was in response to that.
Right. And one of the key things now and every day, the Valley's Planning Council is vigilant about watching how the stress of growth is still kind of encroaching. And they are really careful about the issue of roads. And I didn't think about this. I thought, yeah, open space, just farmland. That's great. Who cares whether there's, you know, roads, you know, winding through these various beautiful fields? The key is that if you build a bigger road, there's more traffic. Then there's more likelihood that developers will say we can drive more people into a space. And you then have that growth that you can't stop. So the Valley's Planning Council has been really, really instrumental in keeping roads narrow, safe, of course. And instead of having traffic lights in intersections, trying to do roundabouts and also making sure that when bridges are rebuilt, that they're not built wider for the, quote, semi-tractor trailer that might have to come through once every 4 years, they keep them narrow. And that way, the roads are used by bikers and hikers, and recreation is a very important part of that system.
The guest in the last part of this program today on Soundbites, Jerry Weingrad, who was a former state senator and was known when he was there as the kind of environmental conscience of the Maryland State Senate. He's often made the argument that, and we don't have to talk about this now because it's not the point of your film, but it made me think of it, made the argument that development just has to stop, that green space and trees and land have to be preserved, not just for people to walk through, but for the future and children, for the environment. And this is a piece of that. I mean, it's a piece of people can often say, well, why should I care where there's some place in Green Spring Valley where a lot of people who are much more well off than I am have this land? But it's more than that.
Absolutely. Well, one of the issues is water quality.
Right.
You know, the aquifer under Baltimore County feeds Pretty Boy Dam and also Loch Raven.
Which is our drinking water.
And we drink that water.
Right.
That's the city takes that water
right.
from the county. Now, if you built landscapes of parking lots and malls all over Baltimore County, you're not going to have the water quality that we have now. And we're very blessed to have such, you know, pure water.
So what was it? Why did you do this film? What was that? Because this has been like a labor of love. You worked on this for years.
2.5 years. Yeah.
That's a long time.
And it is.
And of course, you're making a film.
Well, fortunately, in my career, I'm an independent filmmaker, so I can choose the subjects that I want to study. And I have known the Baltimore County all my life. I grew up, you know, in the Ruxton area, but I had friends out in the northern part of the county. It was a beautiful area, and here was an opportunity to help a nonprofit organization sort of paint the portrait of their 50-year history and have the ability to tell the story not through old historic photographs. And we do have some really great archival footage of some of the designers, but I felt that the important story was how the environment is so vital today. And that required being in the environment, getting up before dawn, shooting snowstorms, and you know, following farmers on their daily routines and kind of building a story around the community of people that care about this land. And therefore, people watching will care about the land.
So what lessons do you think come from this film? I mean, because that's part of what you do as a filmmaker. You're trying to put things out there for people to think about what surrounds them. So people don't live in Baltimore County. They live somewhere else in the state of Maryland. I mean, what do people get from this, do you think? What should we be thinking about in this film?
Well, I think in a way, though, it's not a very political film. I don't, like, have people going to the court and protesting.
I see many things through political lenses, but that'll be my job.
Yeah, I'll let you do that. I'm glad we're here talking about that, too. But I think that by telling a story about people, community that came together, they were not political activists. They were just people who cared about a place. And through their own personal energy and commitment, they created an organization which is really, really important to the politics of Baltimore County, actually.
And I think that it goes to the entire county because now there is a real battle in Baltimore County over questions of development, new housing developments all across the county, expanding the county and threatening the waterways, the pipelines, and these are real issues. And I think people seeing this film can get a sense of what it takes to say no, we can stop and we can control our own environment.
The other thing I think we have to acknowledge is that it's compromise, too. I mean, there are many battles where the current executive director, Teresa Moore, would tell me that, you know, we didn't get what we had wanted completely, but we got a lot. And so you have to, it's give and take. And that's true in any, you know, community. You got to listen to both sides and try to find a safe middle ground.
And I thought the film was also done beautifully. I mean, it was really a very well-made film.
I mean, well, I had a lot of great support. I had actually a lot of my MICA students work on it with me, which is a great teaching experience for them.
Absolutely.
And I had the incredible talents of Caleb Stein doing my music.
That original score he did for this film is amazing. I love Caleb's work anyway.
Yeah.
He's a lovely human being and a wonderful musician. But the score was phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, he really, well, he came out with me on location several times. You know, I got him up at dawn. Well, he wasn't, you know, he was happy to get up with me. And
he's a musician. He's not an early riser.
Well, no, he can be. He has a day job, too.
Okay.
But he got up with me, and we wandered the hills and kind of, he saw me working and kind of got a sense of what I was seeing in the landscape, and it inspired him, which was really exciting.
So very quickly, what was something that came out of it for you that you didn't expect in this Designing with Nature, the plan for the valleys?
Well, I think the real gem for me is realizing the importance of this vision that this man, Ian McCarg, had. And you have to see the film to really appreciate his incredible vision. But there's a couple of clips of him from a previous documentary made by a PBS director up in Boston of Ian standing right where the Maryland Hunt Cup is run. And this is back in 62, 63, and he's looking out and saying, you know, right now, the individuals in this community are fighting to keep the symbol of this valley, septic tanks and toilet paper. And he has these really amazing analogies about how to preserve the land and what will happen if we don't. So those are the kind of priceless moments in a documentary that, you know, you can't really describe on radio.
So I would encourage everybody to watch this film. Designing with Nature, The Plan for the Valleys, will air on Maryland Public Television on April the 22nd, Earth Day, at 10 p.m.
That's right. It's part of the Chesapeake Bay Week, which is a great celebration on MPT next week.
So do not miss this. Alan Moore has been with us, a filmmaker, a faculty member at MICA, who is the man who created this film, Designing with Nature, The Plan for the Valleys. And it's an amazing film that my wife and I saw and really love, and I'm glad you're here and glad it's finally getting air on television.
Mark, thanks so much.
Good to have you here. Before we go to our next segment here on Soundbites, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. It's there. We'll take a brief break. Come right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm talking with former State Senator Jerry Weingrad, who's an attorney, and when he was in the State Senate, was known as the environmental conscience of the Senate. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Policy, where he's been teaching a graduate course on Chesapeake Bay restoration since 1988. So, Jerry, it's always good to see you. Glad to have you in the studio.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's talk about, first of all, let's start off with this session. I mean, you're never afraid to put it out there. No holes barred. So talk to us a bit about, I know that you see, I've seen from your emails, you're looking at this session in Annapolis as being, if not an abject failure, really bad for the environment. This is not much to just croon about, this session.
Correct. Despite the current degraded state of the Chesapeake Bay and the decline in our oyster populations and our fisheries and people getting infections from simply going in the water that threaten their limbs and lives, actually, the General Assembly is kind of laid down and going in reverse on this.
So, like what? I mean, one of the things I know we debate on this show a lot was this act around phosphorus, which you can describe, which was supposed to be implemented by the governor, and then something happened.
Well, for the simplest terms, the battle over phosphorus in manure is really simple, that you shouldn't be putting down chicken manure or other animal manures on farmland that already has tremendous amounts of phosphorus in the soils. So, for instance, in Somerset County, where there's heavy chicken operations, 80% of the land is already supersaturated with phosphorus, and that's one of the two nutrients with nitrogen that causes all of these severe problems in the bay, the algae growth, the dead zones, dead fish, diseases in people and dogs. And so the simple fact is that the state of Maryland, Governor O'Malley, pledged to the EPA that they would introduce a new phosphorus site index, which means this tool that can be used by farmers by taking soil samples. And if your sample showed these very high levels of phosphorus, you could not put down manure because you can't take out the phosphorus from the manure. And there's nitrogen in it too, which runs off into the nearest creek or stream because the soils already have enough phosphorus and poisons the streams.
Saturated over dozens of over decades of use, right?
Decades and decades. And so you've been constantly putting manure out because it's the cheapest.
It sits there in the land. That's where it sits.
Well, it's cheapest way of dispose of it. Some is taken up in crops, but not all because you put so much down. And nitrogen's the same way that's in this manure. So if you were to dispose of 1 ounce from the Back River sewage treatment plant of human biosolids that are treated, it's just the leftover that's been well treated in a sewage treatment plant, or the Patapsco, or any other plant in Maryland, when you land dispose of that and put it into the soil, whether farmland or on highway medians, you have the rules. There's extremely tough rules by the Maryland Department of Environment. And one of those is you can't put it down if there's excess levels of phosphorus in the soil. And that's the way it's been for 28 years. So the governor, 3 years late, behind the pledge to do this to the EPA to meet our pollution diet, the Maryland Department of Agriculture proposes these regs to implement this.
The phosphorus index.
This
tool.
Index done by the University of Maryland agronomists who are favorable to agriculture. And they work it with the Farm Bureau where they think they have their approval. And the next thing, they come out against it. They withdraw the first set of the regs. The people go to the legislature. They withdrew the second set in November that were weakened and time delays for the agricultural community. And now when they're supposed to be coming out and working with the Farm Bureau and the farmers again, the legislature has intervened, and that's Democrats and Republicans, the anti-regulatory, anti-environmental folks. They have succeeded in getting language in the budget that's really could potentially block these regs or delay them for a long time, which is the reverse of where we should be going.
Now, what I understand is this particular thing is this phosphorus index tool, which was implemented with the MDA and, as you say, University of Maryland scientists and the Farm Bureau agreed, and O'Malley could have implemented, the governor could have implemented this year, but didn't. And what they're saying is now they have to go back and do an economic.
Complete economic impact analysis.
Right.
And then they have to come back to the legislature, essentially to a committee, to get approval from that committee, which is extraordinary for these regs that have been worked out.
You spent years in politics. You were in the Senate for how many years, state Senate?
12 and in the House for four. Four,
right. So what is under this? I mean, what happens that after the governor says he's going to implement it, after they've all agreed to say this has to be done, what's the politics of blocking it here at the last minute in this session? What was that about?
Well,
what are we not seeing?
Well, if you make an analogy to coal mining and stripping incredible thousands of acres of mature deciduous forest in West Virginia for coal mining and poisoning people's streams and causing mudslides in what's called mountaintop removal and stream channel disposal. When you fight big coal in West Virginia, big coal wins. And when you fight big chicken and big ag in Maryland, you're going to lose. And so the governor, the legislature, individual folks, just the environmental community, does not and cannot stand up to the incredible ag lobby, and that means Purdue and Tyson Foods and all the big companies that raise chickens on the Eastern Shore. The farmers right away say, this is going to put us out of business, which is just hogwash. You need to properly dispose of that manure. No one should be able to dump these unlimited amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus-containing manure out on fields. Just think of people doing that with their own human sewage untreated. Just think of one neighbor dump 10 ounces of this out of your own waste in your own yard. It's, you know, they'd be arrested. But farmers can dump untreated raw animal manure that in many cases is just as bad or worse, and there's no penalties. There's no enforcement.
The other thing you were talking about was the what happened to the stormwater tax, stormwater runoff tax, that his opponents call the rain tax.
Well, the legislature, first of all, made a bad mistake, and I will acknowledge it, and I think most conservationists will, when they passed a bill that was only a half of loaf. The bill should have applied to all jurisdictions in Maryland, at least the ones that feed into the bay. I mean, Garrett County would be exempted. But They didn't do that. The politics were that MACO, the Maryland Association of Counties, and others at the municipal level and developers and others started to complain that this thing was too broad-based. So the legislature modified it and said only the 10 most urbanized counties where you have the most impervious surfaces from development would this restoration fee be applied. Then they made a more grievous mistake. They didn't set the fee at the legislative level. They left it up to the counties, didn't even say how much, and didn't even say specifically how they had to address stormwater management in their counties. So for urban areas like Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County, Prince George's, Montgomery, you can't possibly clean up your local rivers without dealing with stormwater. Now, rural counties and overall in the Bay, agriculture is the biggest pollutant. But stormwater from existing development and new development is a major problem.
Because
when it rains, just like here outside this studio in the Jones Falls, I saw a big outfall coming in off the Balmer City streets. And from snow melt and from rainstorms, there's just brown water running in with every kind of chemical you can think. There's probably over 100 toxic chemicals in that stormwater, as well as phosphorus and nitrogen from pet waste and from atmospheric deposition, like from car exhaust and from power plant burning of coal. And so that stormwater is poisonous. It really is serious. That's why after rain events, I don't care where you are in Maryland, the health department will tell you, don't go in the water, don't have water contact, even don't have your dogs in the water because it's so poisonous from that stormwater. So it's causing very, very significant problems localized where you have urban development. And Anne Arundel County, where I live, is one of those areas. And so without dealing with the stormwater, you cannot clean your local waters. Now, agriculture is king on the eastern shore, southern Maryland, further north in some of the rural counties and out west, Frederick County. But still, there are stormwater issues there. So the bottom line is that the legislature didn't have the guts, didn't have the political wherewithal, didn't have the serious concern enough for the Bay to overcome these objections of like MACO and limited this bill to only 10 counties, didn't set the fee. So you have Carroll County saying, we're not going to enact the fee. We're going to pay for it, you know, otherwise, or some of it that we're already doing. And we have another county like Frederick County saying, we're enacting a fee. It's $1 a year, you know. And so what does the MDE do when Carroll County thumbs their nose at it? What do you think? They did nothing. They just said, well, as long as you're raising money with your property tax anyway, that's okay. Now, the legislature just snuck language in to an innocuous bill called the BRFA bill, the Budget Reconciliation Financing Act, that almost no one – it's supposed to just be for corrections for the previous year budget and adjusting – that essentially says that if any other county does what Carroll County did, it's okay. It'll be compliance with the law.
So again, it's unfathomable to me that you have a bill that was weak to start with, that most people, because as you said, letting localities do it on their own, certain localities are going to say, no, we're not going to pay anything at all. And other localities of Baltimore, Montgomery County are going to try to do what they can to address it. And then that wasn't good enough. That had to be pushed back. And you have people voting who say they are pro-environment. You have in the delegates and senators. You have a governor who says he's an environmental governor, talking about wind energy off the coast and more. I don't – again, this is not Big Ag Lobby. What is this?
On the stormwater?
Yeah.
It's just the simple fact that the counties push back and
– and the power of the developers.
Basically, the Republican Tea Party wing has pushed back and pushed Democrats into a corner calling this a rain tax. Now, under Governor Ehrlich, the boldest in the last 12 years, the boldest action that was taken was under Governor Ehrlich, who proposed the flush tax, the Bay Restoration Fee, it's called. And everyone in Maryland that is hooked into water or sewer or has a septic, every single household in Maryland except the excluded areas that aren't in the Bay drainage, pay $60 a year right now into the Bay Restoration Fund to clean up the phosphorus and nitrogen in the largest sewage treatment plant, 67. That cost of that cleanup, are you ready for this, is $1.4 billion. And we are way ahead of probably any state in this nation, and we've done a great job. It's the singular success of the Bay Restoration Program is cleaning up sewage treatment plants, not just for human health, but exceeding that to get that excess nutrients out that poison the bay. And that's been done by this financing of everybody that flushes their toilet, gets public water, gets sewage, whether you're on public water or sewage, you're paying into this fee. And this fee is evenly distributed. It was set up by the state. The counties collect it and take 5% off the top. And it will reach 95% of the wastewater to almost the limits of technology, $1.4 billion. But for a stormwater fee, counties are setting minuscule things of a dollar or, you know, Carroll County, nothing. And some are setting, you know, my county, I just paid $51 of my property tax. My property tax went up over $400 from besides that, you know. And I paid $297 a year for my garbage and recycling. Is that a garbage tax, you know? I mean, it's beyond me how they frame this as a rain tax. And the Democrats have picked up on this and gone along with the Republicans in a Democratic-controlled legislature to start bashing on this as well.
So, I mean, we also saw, I mean, it was a combination of developers and religious institutions and companies, and all said, we can't afford this. Churches, we can't afford it. Everybody wanted to be exempted from the bill, and we're pushing on it. And that there's this power lobby of developers and other kind of nonprofit institutions, large ones, that are saying, no, 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 it shouldn't be us. We shouldn't have to pay this. We can't afford it.
Well, they say the hardest, everybody's for change. But the hardest thing to change is yourself. And it's like no one that's opposed the rain tax or the stormwater fees has ever come up with a viable alternative of how to fund these restorations. You've got hundreds of years of development that's destroying the Chesapeake Bay, not only the stripping of the trees, but now instead of the rainfall naturally percolating with into the groundwater through forest cover with all of the decaying matter on the bottom of a forest and absorbing the nutrients, the toxic chemicals, and holding that water and replenishing our drinking water supplies and keeping the temperature steady for trout streams, now you run this off by gravity to the quickest stormwater outfall. So in Anne Arundel County, we have 43,000 acres of impervious surface and something like 33,000 stormwater inlets, you know, where people's streets and all cut into this. I just saw that huge one in the Jones Falls. It was running totally chocolate brown, you know, just from sediment and from all the and there's chemicals in that water, too. So the dynamic is that no one, you know, everyone's for saving the bay. But when it comes to paying your fair share or changing the way you deal with your stormwater around your house, most people don't want to ante up or step up to the plate. And politicians have made this one of the key issues in the gubernatorial campaign or in local county elections, like in our county executive race. Everyone's racing to try to say who is most opposed to the stormwater fee. Even our county executive publicly is saying now, while she vetoed the bill that finally passed over a veto, she's saying, well, we ought to go to the federal government if they're mandating this now. Well, excuse me, what tax would you raise to get the money from the federal government? No, they're just going to cut waste. That's what, you know, the answer would be.
Just not stormwater waste.
Yeah, it's like the county's stormwater. You know, it's their sewage. They're the ones that allowed all this development to occur. So why don't they pay for it? No, they go to the state. The state imposed the Bay Restoration Fee under Governor Ehrlich, the flush tax. It has been a singular success. But some of the same Republicans that think that was a good idea, they think the stormwater fee is a bad idea. Figure it out. I can't. It's got to be politics, and you just use it as a drum roll to intercede, to bash Democrats and bash the taxaholics.
General Weingrat, when you were there on Senate, you were known as the environmental conscience of the state Senate, former state senator, retired commander, is it?
Right, in the Navy.
U.S. Navy, always good to have you here. Thank you so much for the fight you continue. It's always great to have your voice in the air with us.
Thank you for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.